Welcome to Cross-Border Tax Talks, where we discuss the latest trends in international taxation, from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act to the latest tax reform proposals. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's U.S. International Tax Services Leader. You can follow me on Twitter at @exportertax. On this week's episode of Cross-Border Tax Talks, I'm excited to have Rebecca Lee back on the podcast. Rebecca is an international tax partner based in PwC's Washington National Tax Services practice with an emphasis on financial transactions. Rebecca started her career at the National Office of the IRS of Chief Counsel. Rebecca, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Doug. I'm really glad to be here.
So Rebecca, I don't know if you noticed, you've been on the podcast a number of times. I've officially updated now the introduction to the podcast because I can no longer with conscience call the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act tax reform with Tax Reform 2.0 right on the heels of where we are. You and I think, have been practicing almost the same amount of time, over 20 years in this area. We waited a huge portion of our careers for one big international tax reform change in the U.S., and now we might see two. What is your reaction to that? Any thoughts on where things might be headed?
I really have to temper my enthusiasm because as a tax geek, I am jazzed that we could see Tax Reform 2.0 and have a whole bunch of stuff to learn. I think the tough thing is that I put myself in the shoes of our clients, and this is a huge lift. If you're an in-house tax person, we went from sort of, I rewind to late 2017 and trying to think through what will tax reform look like, having to do toll charge and learn all those rules and immediately forget them because then they were relevant and then they weren't. And then moving on to what tax planning looks like in our current environment. And then the idea that, okay, everything you just spent the last 2.5, 3 years learning, forget it. We're now going to do something completely different. It's completely daunting. And so I'm sympathetic and I'm really hoping that whatever comes forth is going to be somewhat intuitive because it's going to be a pretty steep learning curve again.
Yeah, absolutely. I just think of all the complex computational aspects and so much of what we've talked about on the 60 plus episodes of the Cross-Border Tax Talks where we've been contemplating reform and then dealing with reform is just how complicated it is, the need for modeling. And you feel like just as companies and advisors start to feel comfortable with what these rules are, you're right, the prospects of them changing and having to go back and redo things is daunting to say the least. So speaking of daunting, let's talk about 163J. This is a topic you've been on to talk about in the past, but we've recently got some final regulations. And I'm guessing things might be as settled as we're going to see from a 163J perspective, knowing that we also are going to be having some changes that just naturally occur as a result of the TCJA. But before we dive into the final regulations, can you remind our listeners, what is 163J? This really a major change to our interest deductibility rules that came in with TCJA. And then there's been a series of different regulations that we've discussed here on the podcast. Kind of what is it and how did we get here?
Sure thing. So modern 163J is an interest limitation rule that applies both to U.S. corporations and their foreign subsidiaries, as well as non-U.S. persons who have a U.S. trade or business. And it's an interest expense limitation based on the combination of your business interest income plus 30% of your adjusted taxable income. So you can think of it as kind of being 30% of EBITDA. And this acts as a limitation regardless of who the borrowers are. So they can be related parties or not related parties. It is a function solely of the amount of leverage that you have and the amount of taxable income that you have. So aside from the computational complexity of getting your arms around these rules and how they affect your company, there's also kind of this overall policy standpoint of it isn't even about whether you're eroding the U.S. tax base, that there's a certain amount of leverage or interest that is just currently not deductible in the U.S.
Right, and that was really the big change from TCJA from the prior regime, is that in the past it only really applied to intercompany interest, and now, and I think this is a trend that we're seeing across the globe. We know we've seen this with the EU anti-tax avoidance directive, that it's really just an interest limitation on all interest, whether it's related or unrelated, and that really I think was the big change, and there were certainly others.
Absolutely.
So talk a little bit about the process of how we got here from a reg perspective. So I think this started, it doesn't seem that long. I can't decide if it seems like this was 6 months ago or 6 years ago, but it was actually, I think 2018, right, was when we got our first proposed regulations. And talk a little bit about the regulatory process and how we got to these final regs in January of 2021.
Absolutely. So we had our first set of kind of comprehensive proposed regulations in 2018. And those regulations were drafted with the idea that taxpayers could, if they chose to, early rely on them. Those regulations were the subject of over 120 comment letters on all aspects of the computation of the expense limitation. And then in 2020, the IRS, reflecting on those comments, did two things. They took the portions of the regulations that they were comfortable they could address all the comments within the construct of a final regulation, that they weren't so fundamentally changing the regulations that they could finalize them as proposed, and they finalized those regulations. And at the same time, they reproposed on two significant sets of regulations, as well as some other cats and dogs. And so in 2020, we had regs that went final, we had regs that were proposed in a different form. And those regulations that were proposed in a different form were then finalized this year, 2021, in January. So we kind of have, depending on what specific issue or what piece of the limitation you're looking at, depending on a point in time, you could be looking at the statute alone, the statute plus a proposed reg, a statute plus final regs and proposed regs, or all final regs, which is certainly tough. And I have to applaud one of the messages that we've gotten from our folks in government who worked on these reg packages is that they really tried to take seriously taxpayer comments that were submitted. And while they didn't take a lot of them, and not even all the ones that I drafted, they really attempted to thoughtfully address all the comments that were provided, which is why we had a set that were reproposed rather than the IRS kind of just plowing ahead and finalizing what they had proposed so that they could check off that they finalized all their tax reform guidance.
Yeah. So later in the podcast, we'll come back to that ordering and that timeline, because you're right. It's certainly confusing, and it depends, you know, when clients' taxable years end and what the positions are for each of these respective periods where we had potentially different rules applying. So we'll come back to that. So before we sort of break into some of the specific provisions in the final regulations, I wanted to note that the final regulations were released on January 5th, and then they were published in the Register on January 19th. So we obviously had a change of regime on January 20th, so the next day, right, with the inauguration of President Biden and a new Democratic-controlled Congress. So a question for you, Rebecca, is what is the process for regs that are issued at the end of an administration? And is there a chance that you will spend all this time on these regulations and they could get pulled under either the Congressional Review Act, or, you know, the new administration might use the Administrative Procedures Act to pull these regs? What should taxpayers, advisors, and others think about the fact that this was really kind of pushed in the day before the inauguration?
Well, first things first, I mean, one of the reasons that they published on the 19th was not coincidental, because regulations that are pending at the Federal Register, which had been sent for publication but not yet published, are kind of fair game for the current, for the incoming administration to just freeze and not do anything with. And so you saw this raft of not just tax guidance, but a whole host of regulatory guidance all being pushed through the Register on the 19th, so at least they would be final regulations. And you hit the nail on the head. There are a few different administrative ways in which, if the incoming administration wanted to re-examine the final regulations, they could choose to take a second look at them, either from an APA review standpoint, you know, was this an appropriate use of rulemaking? Did they comply with the agency's obligations for notice and comment? And especially in the case of 163J, was there a relatively detailed analysis under the various rules under which administrative rulemaking has to be evaluated, which includes not just the normal notice and comment rules under the APA, but the Reg Flex rules and the Paperwork Reduction Act as well. So you got all these competing things and the overarching ability to step back and look at whether these are good policy or not. Now, that all being said, if I were a betting person, having been through more than a few changes of administration, I would suspect this is not a place where the administration is going to look back and want to make material changes. I think if anything, there's more focus prospectively on the legislative agenda and whether or not you save the DAW in doing your 163J calculation. But you know, it's not outside the realm of possibility. I just think that there are bigger things on the administration's agenda that will probably move the needle a little bit more.
Well, I think a lot of us hope for that. I guess it depends on where certain taxpayers may have come out on these final regulations. But certainly having some certainty, I know, is something that we all yearn for. So I guess we'll have to wait and see how these stand up. So let's unpack some of the final regulations. We'll leave the international stuff to the end as a hook for our listeners. But let's start with some of the more kind of domestic and maybe definitional changes that we saw. Where do you want to start, Rebecca? Maybe with like the recapture of ATI and some of the changes with respect to dispositions and how adjusted taxable income is computed.
I would even say if we can give 2 seconds of airtime to the definition change, this is one of those sleeper changes that people think they don't care about if they're kind of not in the asset management space. And this actually has a huge impact for corporate treasurers.
Let's do it.
All right. So the way the rules changed, the original definition of interest, like what you get a dollar for dollar credit for in terms of being able to take an interest expense deduction, because your business interest expense is business interest expense minus business interest income. That definition included all things that are interest from a U.S. federal income tax standpoint. And very commonly, corporate treasurers, they think of things in the world of cash and cash equivalents. And what a lot of corporate treasurers didn't realize is that they were investing in money market funds, either U.S. or non-U.S., and that those instruments were actually paying dividends rather than interest from a U.S. federal income tax standpoint. And when you rent to run, for example, a standalone 163J calculation on a treasury center, all of a sudden you have the potential to give rise to a limitation for an entity that's really just borrowing money and then depositing it and getting a rate of return because the thing you were investing in paid something labeled as a dividend. And a number of industry groups commented on this, and IRS and Treasury wrote a rule that they proposed and then ultimately finalized in a slightly altered form to say if you invest in a U.S. mutual fund that is a money market fund or otherwise pays an interest equivalent dividend, you'll get to treat that as if it's interest for your 163J calculation. And this solved what was going to be a massive trap for the unwary, but I will warn you, it's limited to U.S. mutual funds. So if you have two basically identical investments and one is in a U.S. money market fund and the other is in an Irish UCIT or a Lux CCAB or a similar product, one is going to give you dollar for dollar credit against your interest expense limitation and the other is going to give you 30 cents on the dollar. So this is one that I make sure that it's not real interesting to tax people, but it's incredibly important to corporate treasurers because it will drive how they deploy their excess cash.
Yeah, and that's just a common theme, right, that we've seen as far as tax interacting with other aspects of the business. And so it's a great point, Rebecca, that, you know, the treasurer, absent this particular tax outcome, might be agnostic as far as a U.S. mutual fund or a foreign one. And so it would be obviously important for the treasurer to understand what those after-tax implications could be between the two investments. So let's talk a little bit about dispositions, because I know there were a couple of changes in that area and how that impacts the computation of adjusted taxable income.
And all of these changes were intended to be clarifying in nature. So essentially, there was a set of changes in the rules defining how you compute adjusted taxable income, And then there was a similar set of rule changes in the corporate area, basically to tell you if you have a depreciable asset or one for which there's amortization or depletion, and you dispose of the asset, the basic rule is a lesser of rule, that the amount that gets added back to ATI is going to be the lesser of the amount of depletion or depreciation you took or your gain on the property. So if you sold something at a loss or at a smaller gain, you don't have to add back the whole thing. And then there were a series of corporate rules that extended that to give you rules where you dispose of the property in a non-recognition transaction. Because the goal was to prevent there from being selectivity on whether you structure something as a taxable sale or as sort of transfer of assets in a non-recognition transaction, depending on whether you're underwater or not on the particular property being disposed. So all of these are things that have big impacts from a computational standpoint in terms of how companies are running their models, especially if you're in capital intensive businesses. But we're not viewed as being hugely controversial from a policy standpoint.
Got it. And then there were also some changes we'll cover briefly, sort of C-corps, consolidated groups, and then partnerships. Maybe we start with C-corps and the consolidated groups. Any highlights or lowlights, as the case may be, in that area?
On the consolidated side, I think there were some cleanup comments primarily to address this kind of lesser of rule and to pull it through, not just for non-recognition transactions generally, but to the extent that there are transfers within a U.S. consolidated group. Now, the partnership rules, I am pretty jazzed about, mostly because I live with a partnership tax person. So what he's psyched about, I'm psyched about. But the big change there was the finalization of all the litany of partnership rules around how you go about computing the 163J calculation at the entity level for partnerships that are engaged in a trader business, and then how those attributes flow up. And they retained the 11-step process that had been proposed in the regulations, and which candidly, I think at one point when our partnership folks were walking us through an example, I thought they were joking when they said it's an 11-step process. I was like, you have to be kidding me. But they retained that architecture, and they provided some adjustments around things like, what do you do with non-materially participating partners? And this is a big issue in the asset management space, particularly with funds that are engaged in a trader business, which kind of lives in this space of, you're certainly a trader business, as that term is used for 162 purposes, but oftentimes you may have differences in treatments for partners who are materially participating, like the manager who manages the daily trading versus partners that are limited partners. This area is hugely complex. And frankly, I don't try to dive into it too deeply without phoning a friend and pulling in one of our sub-K folks.
Yeah, the partnership stuff admittedly makes my head absolutely spin. I can only imagine the interesting dinner time conversation that you have with your husband on this area. My wife is a retired educator, so we don't have to get into any of the intricacies of the partnership 163J rules at dinner for sure. So let's move now, which you know I'm excited to talk about, the international pieces of this, and specifically the CFC group election. And because this took up a whole big portion of the final regs. So can you just remind everybody just what is the CFC group election and how does it work? Because there's been just a lot of commentary and discussions of whether 163J should even apply at the CFC level. And if it does, how does it apply? And heck, I remember right after the TCJA, I was on a panel and with a member from Treasury, and you could tell there wasn't even agreement within Treasury as far as whether 163J should apply at the CFC level. I remember there was the proposed reg obviously applied it at the CFC level. And then when I had somebody on a panel discussing it, you could tell that individual didn't even support the proposed reg as it was drafted, which was the first time for me that had happened, which I found both intellectual interesting and entertaining. So remind us, what is the CFC group election and how does 163J generally apply for CFCs and as we think about GILTI in particular?
So I'll start with the easy portion of the question. So with the 2020 final regulations, those regulations laid out that 163J, that interest limitation, applies at the CFC level for the computation of each CFC's items of income deduction gain or loss, so going into their computation of subpart F income or GILTI. And Doug, you flagged, like, this was not a point beyond sort of debate up until those regulations were finalized. And they drew really heavily on the 952-2 rule that you compute your income as if you were a U.S. person. So we have this predicate of, we now have a limitation that I apply on a legal entity or by legal entity basis or by a CFC by CFC basis. And much like other rules that attempt to put you sort of in a spot where transactions amongst your CFCs don't necessarily increase your global income, if we can think of by analogy things like CFC look through. What the group election is trying to do at its core is limit your interest expense based on the leverage of your foreign group. And that definition of what sort of is eligible to make a group elections, it's optional. It is not mandatory. If you make this optional election, you're basically opting into a regime that looks an awful lot like the U.S. consolidated return regime. They're trying to almost have you treated like divisions of a single corporation. If you opt into this regime to be eligible, you have to have 80% common ownership. And that can be common ownership up to a top tier CFC or to a U.S. shareholder. And that was a big change in the 2020 proposed regulations, fixing what I think was an unintended consequence of the regulations that were proposed in 2018, where you had to go all the way up to a U.S. shareholder. You can make this election, for example, if you're a minority investor into a foreign group, but that foreign group, sort of, they're a CFC to you and they tier all up to a top tier CFC that owns at least 80% of the lower tier CFCs. So that's the mechanics of who can make the election. Now, if you make the election, you go about kind of computing what would be the adjusted taxable income and the 163J limitation as if all of these were divisions of a single corporation. And there's some very specific mechanics to that, but the goal is to get you to a limitation that properly reflects almost the amount of external leverage that the CFC group has, rather than trying to have individual CFCs have limitations based on intercompany transactions.
And you had talked about the when a taxpayer can make the election. Can you talk about when is that done? And then if a company decides, if a company decides to make a group election, can that be revoked? What is the process actually on a making that election and potentially changing that?
Even this has changed. So in the final regulations, you make the election with the tax return. There is a form that you file. That form has not been updated for 2021 yet. So right now, if you pull the form, it looks like you're making it for every single individual CFC. So you have to, if you imagine how many CFCs you may have in your international structure, that's a lot of forms. They're fixing that. But for the moment, there's a form that you file. And then each subsequent year, you file a statement or a disclosure with your U.S. federal income tax return, identifying that you have made the group election. And from a mechanics standpoint, you can make the election at any time. IRS and Treasury debated whether they wanted to have a rule that said in the first year that the regulations were finalized, you either have to make a decision to opt into the group election or not. And if you chose not, you would have to wait 60 months before you could choose again. They opted not to have that kind of limitation. So if you're sitting here thinking about your group for 2021 and you're a calendar year taxpayer, you could make the election for 21. You can make it for 22. You can make it for any subsequent year. Once you've made the election, you do have the ability to revoke. And if you revoke the election, a lot like our entity classification elections, you have to wait for 60 months before making a fresh election. And there's one piece of the election that I think is really a trap for the unwary. In the first year you make the election, I keep kind of using the analogy to our U.S. consolidated return rules. In the first year that you make the election, and you may have individual CFCs that have their own 163J carry forward and other attributes, there is a Surly-like limitation on any carry forward of attributes. So there's a really gating decision on when you make that first year election, what's going to be the impact for CFCs that have had prior year limitations. And one way in which the final regs intend to address that is they say, look, if you made a group election previously under the version that was published in the 2018 proposed regs or the version that was published in the 2020 proposed regulations, we're going to treat all of the CFCs that were part of that prior group election as one big CFC for purposes of determining the Surly limitation when you make the new group election. So if you're one of these companies that back in 18 said, I can't imagine a scenario where I'm worse off making the group election, I'll go ahead and make it now, you're not going to be in a situation where you have a Surly limitation coming into your first sort of final regs group election. Versus for a lot of companies that we work with who, because of the uncertainty, because of the constantly evolving nature of these regulations, did not early adopt any of the regs, we have this day one transition issue about how do you deal with individual CFCs with their own attributes and how much limitation are you looking at?
Yeah. And then also, you know, given just what a dynamic macroeconomic environment that we've had, you know, just trying to model for these changes. And then with the goalposts constantly moving, it's been a challenge for taxpayers. And so I think some of this flexibility is welcome, although I think, you know, some may have preferred for additional flexibility without the 60-month limitation, but can certainly understand government's position on that. A couple of other pieces wanted to get your thoughts on the expansion of the anti-abuse rule. I know there were a lot of discussions with respect to the anti-abuse rule. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a reg package where the anti-abuse rules have anti-abuse rules. There's a general anti-abuse rule in the reg package that was kind of finalized. There's a general CFC anti-abuse election. And then there was also a clarification in the anti-abuse election or in anti-abuse rule. And basically what it said was the original version said, if you engage in a transaction to affect your adjusted taxable income that the IRS has the right to challenge the transaction. What they added was if you engage in a transaction which either artificially kind of increases business interest income or decreases business interest expense. So instead of looking at the effect of the transaction or transactions on adjusted taxable income as a whole, they also added that if you're engaging in transactions which similarly improve your limit by virtue of affecting your amount of interest expense or interest income, they give themselves kind of fair game to go after those types of transactions as well. And one of my favorite points that I always feel obligated to bring up is that we talked earlier about the Administrative Procedure Act. And one of the things that is always tough anytime we're thinking about any kind of anti-abuse rule is that once the IRS has vested themselves with discretion on how to apply an anti-abuse rule, the application of that discretion on a taxpayer by taxpayer basis isn't limitless. It kind of feels limitless because they give themselves the authority to challenge the transaction and to recharacterize it. But that act of use of administrative discretion is governed by things like an abuse of discretion standard. So as broad as these rules are, we both have to assess, did I do something that the regulations thought would be violative of their purpose? And also, have I done something that under the Administrative Procedures Act, the administrative agency here, the IRS, can rightfully challenge? And when I've raised some of these questions with folks from the IRS on public panels, one of the things they always remind me of is that with respect to this specific rule change, there are a couple of examples in the preamble of what exactly they were trying to get at and the transactions that were of concern to them. And they said, hey, you know, examples in a preamble, not controlling, but they may give you some color as to how we're thinking about the application of the anti-abuse rule. And while that isn't controlling, I do think it is really helpful as folks assess the impact that the rule can have, because it is difficult when you sit in the taxpayer's shoes to figure out, I have a very broad anti-abuse rule, especially where I didn't go into it with an abusive intent. How do I figure out which side of the rule that I'm on, both for provision purposes, as well as how I'm going to file the return?
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see if we get additional guidance on that as that takes shape to understand, you know, what the government's position is, particularly as it applies to some of those very broadly worded anti-abuse rules. Maybe the last thing before we talk about maybe what wasn't finalized, the updated new safe harbor election. Tell us about the safe harbor for taxpayers.
So this is something where we asked for something helpful and we got something kind of helpful. There was a safe harbor proposed. Basically, it came out of a number of client conversations we had where folks said, I know I don't have a 163J limit. And I don't want to have to go through the mechanics of making the group election or doing all these complicated calculations. All of my borrowing is in the United States. I just don't have any limitation at my CFCs. But to do the work, to run the calculation is going to be so burdensome. Is there any relief? And the IRS had provided a proposed safe harbor election that allowed you to elect to do a simplified calculation. You still have to look at adjusted taxable income coming up from all of your CFCs, which IRS would rightly point out is information you should have on your 5471s anyway. And then you compare that to your interest expense. And if your adjusted taxable income coming up on all your 5471s is greater than 30% of your interest expense, you don't have to run the more detailed calculations. And that was somewhat helpful. IRS and Treasury added an additional prong to say, look, even easier, if you can prove your business interest income is greater than your business interest expense, such that you do not have net business interest expense to be subject to limitation, you don't even have to do the exercise of going through all the 5471s and calculating total adjusted taxable income. So it was a change that was intended to be helpful and make the safe harbor election more accessible for, you know, companies that at the end of the day aren't going to have a 163J election. I will say this becomes a data management exercise because once you have all of your data for your adjusted taxable income aggregated, and you have the business interest income and business interest expense numbers kind of all aggregated, I don't know how much time you're saving versus running the full calculation, but it's there for folks that this might save a little bit of time.
Right. And I think anytime those comments are specifically noted is certainly welcome. And so we appreciate that. On the let's talk about what they didn't finalize. And so there are a couple of important pieces related to adjusted taxable income of CFCs taken into account by U.S. shareholders, as well as the ECI rules, I think at least were the two items to note from my perspective. Can you expand on that and then anything else maybe of note that wasn't finalized as part of this package and that we still may be wanting or waiting for guidance of whenever that might come?
I think on this first point, the failure to finalize the rules specific to the U.S. shareholder, I was getting emails before I had gotten the PDF open saying, wait a second, they didn't finalize rules on this. This is amazing. Because this is the single biggest reason that clients make the 163J group election for their CFCs. You make the group election in large part because you want the benefit of getting an increase to your limitation in the United States for the excess taxable income of your CFCs. So stepping back, the 2020 final regulations did finalize one piece of the overall kind of what do I do with my CFC regime. They said, as a U.S. shareholder or as a member of a U.S. consolidated group, you don't get credit for the subpart F income, the GILTI, or the 78 gross up in terms of calculating your adjusted taxable income. And your only ability to sort of access any addition to your taxable income from the fact that you have CFCs that have excess taxable income, that have available capacity from a 163J standpoint, comes from making a group election and getting the benefit that's provided by those regs. And when I say the benefit, you notice I'm being a little squirrely about that, because in the 2018 proposed regulations, there was a very detailed bottoms-up tiering approach where you would start from the bottom of the structure and you would calculate the excess taxable income for that CFC. And then you'd go up a level and up a level. And there were all sorts of odd results that popped out of that. For example, if you hit an entity that had ECI, you didn't get any credit for anything below it. If you hit an entity with a deficit, you could lose all the lower chain excess taxable income. And so there are some things there that folks had concern about. So there was a version proposed in the 2020 regs that calculated it differently. You did it kind of on a group-wide basis. You didn't do it tiering up from the bottom. Rather, you calculated the excess taxable income on a group-wide basis. And then you took kind of an allocable portion of that. And that's what the U.S. shareholder was able to take into account in increasing its 163J limitation. And if you notice, when I say kind of you're taking a portion of it, oftentimes you ended up with a less favorable result than under the 2018 proposed regulations, depending on your facts. And then there were a number of comment letters submitted on the mechanics of that calculation, and I think some unintended consequences. And so IRS and Treasury thought about those comments and just decided to reserve on what happens to the U.S. shareholder. And they said they're just continuing to consider it. They plan to publish subsequent guidance. And this is really hard for companies that are trying to figure out the all-in impact of the rules, because this is the most important reason for making the election. The other piece that wasn't finalized is they reserved wholesale on the impact of 163J for taxpayers who are not U.S. taxpayers. So what do you do with 163J for the calculation of effectively connected income? And what do you do if you're a CFC and you also have some effectively connected income? How do you allocate your interest expense to those two activities and then determine your 163J limitation for your effectively connected income sort of generating activities? And so those two reserve sections, frankly, leave our inbound colleagues a little bit out in the cold in terms of specific rules. The prior proposed regs had been leveraging very heavily the 882-5 allocation rules. And the intention behind that reserve section, from what we understand, was not that there should be any negative inference, that they thought that the rules proposed didn't work as intended. They really just didn't have time to get through fully considering and finalizing everything. And they were looking for places where they could kind of draw a clean line and reserve on things that weren't quite ready to be finalized. But these are two pretty significant holes. And in the absence of final guidance, I think it does leave folks in the position of having to determine what is a reasonable approach and which sets of guidance previously published can I rely on?
Yeah, so I think that might be a good way to end things here, Rebecca. So that's a great example of when should taxpayers apply what regulations. And here in this example, we don't actually have a final regulation. In a number of the provisions that we've discussed, we do have final regulations. But then, what any broad words of wisdom for taxpayers insofar as what rules should they apply when? And I appreciate that it's going to really depend on the individual fact pattern, but we have three arguably distinct sets of rules depending on what area we're talking about. What advice do you have for taxpayers on how to apply what rules when?
I'll start from the simplest point, which is you got to look at what did you previously adopt. So each set of proposed and final regulations, so the 2018 proposed regulations, the 2020 final regulations, and the 2020 proposed regulations, as well as, frankly, the final regulations published in 2021, each said that you as a taxpayer and all of your related parties can choose to early adopt any of the regulations prior to the effective date of the final regulations applicable to that section. And specifically, with respect to the 2020 final regulations, they even said you can go back and amend your returns up until the due date for the 2020 tax return, and go back and early adopt one of the sets of proposed regulations or early adopt the final 2020 regulations for a year prior to which they're effective. And lots of folks had other non-international tax reasons for doing that, whether it related to the definition of interest or the determination of how ATI was calculated more generally. Folks already took positions on whether they adopted the 2018 proposed regs or the 2020 final but not yet effective regs. And I mention this because each of those reg packages in that early adoption language said you have to adopt the regulations in their entirety. So oftentimes folks looking at it with a domestically really good decision on, say, adopting the 2018 proposed regulations, but didn't realize that the drag along effect was that you were taking the CFC rules as they existed in the 2018 proposed regulations. That is one lens to look at it. The other lens that I always bring is any of these sets of regulations are intended to be a reasonable interpretation of the statute. The IRS and Treasury in crafting rules under a statute have a certain amount of interpretive flexibility. And oftentimes, many of these rules, whether it's the definition of interest or frankly, what do we do in terms of a U.S. shareholders inclusion, they're trying to come up with what's a reasonable way of interpreting the statute. So oftentimes the exercise we go through is to say, are some of these positions we could have reached even without a regulation directly on point so that I don't have to early adopt an entire reg package to adopt an interpretation similar to the one that I want to adopt. And that really becomes relevant when a company has made a prior early adoption decision. It also becomes relevant for our folks who are following the statute and trying to figure out in years subject, you know, prior to all these regs being effective, what do I do with some of these places where there's no guidance? And the one other reminder that I'd throw out to folks is, and this surprised me on a call last week, because of the timing of the final 2020 regs and then these regulations, for folks that have, say, summer year ends and early fall year ends, you may feel like in a lot of the tax reform guidance, you are on the later end of being affected in terms of effective dates. You may have taxable years where the 2020 final regs and the 21 final regulations are all effective in the same year. For example, if you're a 630 year end company, all of those regs are going to be effective for the taxable year beginning 6/30/2021. So it's a lot sooner than you think.
Well, just a lot of complexity. And Rebecca, you always do such a great job. I appreciate kind of bringing some clarity to a very complicated topic and just thinking about the various layers of these regs and when they apply, and particularly for fiscal year taxpayers. It's a very, very challenging environment. So thank you very much, Rebecca, for all of the clarity.
Thank you.
So thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Cross-Border Tax Talks. A special thanks to Rebecca Lee, a partner in PwC's Washington National Tax Services practice. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's International Tax Services leader. Stay tuned in 2 weeks for another exciting edition of the Cross-Border Tax Talks podcast.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates and may sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.